Well, see, that would happen randomly. Normally, it would just sound like robot underwater, but then it would randomly sound like a robot and an asshole being clenched.
To another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are my co-host, Richard Wally.
And in California, you are Cassidy Robinson. I didn't say your full name. I get in trouble when I do that.
What's my full name?
Race Cassidy Robinson.
My banking name?
Your banking name, yes.
Yeah. My slave name?
Yes. I shouldn't find that as funny as I do.
What have you been up to this week? You said you had kind of a tale to tell.
Oh, I don't know if it's that much of a tale, but just an update for everybody who was worried. I got the other half of my couch. It's a full couch now, full sectional. It's very comfy. I did have to stay up for a longer than 24 hours to get it.
Why?
'Cause human beings don't give a shit if you tell them, like, you know, I can tell people I work nights. I can tell people whatever. I can tell people, I have this horrible life crippling chronic insomnia, and the people are just like, okay, cool. I'm going to come at 9. And you're like, okay, it's more convenient for me. Oh, okay, cool. Thank you. Thank you.
Unfortunately, Richard, the rest of the world runs on working hours, and most people like to do things before noon so that they're not working late into the afternoon.
It's true, but I mean, come on, you know that considerations could be made for some people, especially in those cases. But don't be a jerk. You're just jealous because you have to do the day job stuff now. Like a couple months ago, you would have been all over that.
Right.
But no, it's true. Like,
you it's can't, still like, hard. It's still hard. You never, I mean, maybe some people get used to it, but I have yet to acclimate to it. Like, every morning is a struggle.
Well, I wonder too, because, like, I mean, the thing is like, I'm fine, like, noon to whatever, you know, and that's still business hours. But for some reason, like, when I say, oh, it would be much better if I could do it and that something in the afternoon, people are like, no, the morning. And it's like, okay, do you have something going on? No. Oh, okay. Thank you for that.
Well, in the case of delivery people, I really think it is. It's like, they probably map it out, like, so that they're doing their deliveries so that when they're
the furthest away and then they're
coming closer to home by the end of the day, so it's probably you're at the mercy of their route.
I get it, but it just it plagues me. And recently, because we've had to do it so often, it's been like two or three times a week that I've had to, like, wake up early just to, like, let somebody in for like 10 to 15 minutes.
Well, quit delivering things.
I should. But yeah, no, so I'm the lack of sleep is happening in the brain hole. And
I think that's you at your best.
More or less.
I think there's a balance between insomnia and rested. And we don't want you too rested, because then you're a little too, I don't know, you're a little too present. We kind of want you, I think, just...
just a little off.
Just a little bit of a haze of insomnia over your madness.
You don't want me full mania. I see.
We don't want you in your final form.
Well, it's coming. It's coming, sir. So, but I decided to be nice and, like, clean up and start putting everything away. So I start doing that.
And that's how you use your morning and night?
Yes.
Like a meth head?
Yes, like a meth head, but without the meth.
Right.
I'm a meth head without the meth. So I go outside because I have to empty the vacuum, because I'm going to be nice and clean up and, you know, do the full thing for my wife. And I go outside and I unscrew it, and like these big parts fall out of the vacuum cleaner and into the garbage. And not only that, all of a sudden this like dust storm, like Prince of Arabian style, covers me that comes dumping out of it. And like, it's like head to like knee.
Right.
And this is like 11 in the morning, and that's just, that's when you give up.
Right.
That's when I just go, okay, I've been up for more than 24 hours. It's done. It's done. But anyways, I had to fish out, like, I had to get a tennis racket and, like, fish out the parts from the dumpster. I had to desanitize everything, wash all the parts, wash myself. It was one of those days.
Mm-hmm. Now we have to get sad, Richard.
I don't want to do this.
I know, but it's too big not to.
I haven't gotten past my first stage that lasts for years. Of grief.
Right.
Denial.
You're still in denial.
So. I'm still in denial for things that happened 10 years ago. It just hasn't happened, really.
Well, unfortunately, just yesterday, I think it was announced that a horror director, horror legend, some might say, Wes Craven died.
Mm-hmm.
76?
So, yeah, I believe so.
Mm-hmm. Apparently he was suffering from a brain tumor that he didn't ever come public with. He hadn't made a movie since Scream 4, which was like 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, I was still
like 2011.
It was played at the theater, so it had to be a while ago.
Uh-huh. And he's an executive producer, was an executive producer on the Scream television series that's on MTV right now, which I think just had their last episode tonight. But yeah, you know, kind of a bummer. We'll never see another Wes Craven movie. And I think, you know, I would say he's definitely kind of a hot and cold director. He's gone for, like, we've talked about this a lot, where he'll make the best movie of his career and then right next to it make the worst movie of his career.
Sure, yeah.
And he pretty much did that throughout his entire career. So it was always kind of a, you would always go see the next Wes Craven movie because you never knew what you were going to get.
I think the last few years it's been mostly waning.
Right. It had been a little while since he'd made a really great film. I'd say probably the last really good movie he made was Red Eye.
Which I haven't seen, actually.
Oh, you should. I would say that's a really recommendable. It's kind of a little bit of a Talking Heads thriller. It's a little outside of his wheelhouse. It's a little bit more grown up in a lot of ways. Cillian Murphy and Rachel McAdams, are stuck on a plane together.
Well, he more than had the capability of making those kind of movies. I mean, he was a humanities teacher in college. Mm-hmm. He was an English professor. And so, I mean, he definitely had the acumen. And in some of his, even in some of his horror, you could really tell that he played with kind of themes and...
he loved to play with ideas. His best horror movies were always dealing in something, whether, you know, his early films, exploitation movies like Last House on the Left and The Hills Have Eyes are dealing with themes of violence and revenge fantasy and, like, you know, violence begetting more violence and nobody wins in the end, or, you know, pretty nihilistic. And then later, you know, with Nightmare on Elm Street, he's dealing with the sins of the father kind of metaphors, and then, you know, all the way up into Scream and New Nightmare, he starts to deal in kind of film about film and meta stuff. And
Scream often gets dismissed, but that's what I still think that's one of his better films, because it really does just the when it came out and what it was talking about and how it used its characters and the way it used, you know, the themes about a fairly, I would say, dumb niche genre of a genre. It was quite an interesting and smart take. Some of the stuff, too, like the actual actor Jamie, referring to Jamie Lee Curtis. And it was just there was a lot of really neat little touches in that film.
Right. And you know, he completely both revitalized his career, which was at the point kind of at a low point. And also revitalized that genre. That after Scream, there was a bunch of Scream ripoffs that came out for the next 4 years.
Yeah.
Or longer. And I think Mark Kermode posted a video kind of memoriam video where he said, he was maybe quoting another critic, but he said something to the effect of, Wes Craven reinvented the horror genre 4 times. Most people don't get to do that once in their career.
Sure.
And it's true. You know, like, basically every time you can look at, like, you know, the course of horror history, and, like, at least, like, 4 times it kind of took a left turn was because of one of his movies.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he'll be sorely missed. And I'm still mourning, and if I can fit it in through the week, I'm probably going to be watching some of my favorite Wes Craven movies. And I'm going to ask you, what is your favorite Wes Craven movie?
Gun to my head.
Mm-hmm.
The Hills Have Eyes.
Really? The original Hills Have Eyes?
Yes.
That's an interesting choice. All right. That wouldn't be my choice, but it's... do you want to say why in particular?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, they kind of added to it in the remake recently, but, like, I always liked, besides just the idea of these mutations, nuclear mutations living in the hills, hillbilly mutations, nonetheless.
Right, yeah.
I really just like that like, that small family trapped in the wilderness, what depths will they go to kind of...
Protect themselves and...
Yeah, because, I mean, a seemingly nice family, what will they really do in that kind of a situation? Mm-hmm. And I think that those themes are more interesting than people...
give it credit for.
Yeah, because it's funny because we all, like, we go, oh, I would never do that. But I don't know if that's true in many situations. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, and, like, Last House on the Left, he took a lot of the same ideas and I think kind of refined them for Hills Have Eyes.
For sure, yeah. Last House on the Left has some, is kind of a strange movie because some of the musical choices, some of the, just like the random scenes, yeah. Some of the weird jokes.
Tonally, it's all over the place. And, right. And it's definitely, he was a very young filmmaker at the time, kind of didn't know what he was doing, and made it for bottom of the barrel, low budget. But I think all of that kind of adds to a weirdness to that movie that makes that movie what it is.
It has a strange... I'll say charm, but that's sort of a strange word to be talking about it. But no, it has a real flavor to it.
That right. It's a movie that I think that if you are a professed horror fan, you have to have seen. And not that washed out modern remake that, like, completely undoes the meaning of the original. You have to see the 1972 one for all of its flaws and for all of its wackiness and for all of its politically incorrect weirdness. It is an artifact that must be seen, but I would not say that that's my favorite Wes Craven movie. I mean, if I'm being honest, mm-hmm. if I'm just going from my gut, I would say my favorite is probably Nightmare on Elm Street, the first one.
Yeah. No, I wasn't saying his best. I was saying my favorite.
No. Yeah. But if I want to pick a cooler answer,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to say, Serpent in the Rainbow. Because I think that's a movie that a lot of people haven't seen. And there's a kind of... The first half of that movie almost has, like, a documentary-ish vibe to it. Like, he there's a lot of handheld when it shows, like, Bill Paxton going through the streets of Haiti. And there's a lot of non-actors all over the place. And he uses the environment in a really kind of interesting way. And it's right. more of a psychological horror film than the rest of his movies. It kind of runs off the rails by the last third. But... It's, I think, in a lot of ways, a really interesting movie and a little bit more of, maybe a little bit more mature than some of his movies.
I can agree with that. I will also agree that the last, I don't even know if it's third. I think it's just like last like 5-10 minutes. You're like, okay.
Right.
And I think it just dates kind of funny, too. I think mm-hmm. it might have, I don't know. I would have to see what some of the reviews were at that time period, but.
They're mixed. I know, because the book was. Very renowned at the time, and the movie definitely strays from it. But okay. I really like Bill Paxton's performance in it, and I really like the way he uses the environment of Haiti and the idea of, like, mysticism and, like, and the questioning of other cultures. And it's a smarter movie than people give it credit for.
Mm-hmm.
But we gotta move on.
Yep.
So R.I.P. Wes Craven.
It just sounded awkward.
In my head, I see Freddy's claw, like, popping out of his grave and, you know, all of that.
You needed to provide the visual first. So.
Right. I have to do that. But let's move on now to the movie news.
Mm-hmm.
And
why don't you go first since you're doing two?
Right. We'll go ahead and start with this one. Joaquin Phoenix is set to reteam with M. Night Shyamalan in a Jason Blum production, Blumhouse, who's been producing all of these like kind of popcorn horror films, like the Insidious movies and The Conjuring. And I think they have their hands. Do they have their hands in the Paranormal Activity movies?
Paranormal Activity, The Purge.
The Purge,
Sinister.
Yeah.
Sinister.
If you've seen a horror movie in the last like 10 years, it's probably one of theirs.
Yeah, they have some other ones that I'm forgetting too. So it's
right.
It's a pretty big production company.
Now, Joaquin Phoenix and M. Night Shyamalan worked together previously in The Village, which I think is a really underrated movie. I know a lot of people weren't very keen on it, but I think it, I think it's worth another look. And M. Night Shyamalan has another movie coming out later this year. What is it called? You know, the one with the old people?
Yeah, that's the only thing. I think it's The Visit.
The
Visitor. Or something like that. But it's, I just remembered as the grandma movie. Yeah.
The grandma movie, yeah. And so we'll see how that works out. You know, he's still in the doghouse for a lot of people, and rightfully so. He's made quite a few turkeys in a row.
A lot of people have been... I've heard a lot of people. I haven't checked it out myself, but the TV show, he... I think he maybe only did the first episode, or he's a creator or part showrunner on it. I'm not sure, but the... Oh, it sounded like a Twin Peaks ripoff to me. Wayward Pines, I think.
Okay.
I know a lot of people are actually positive on that, but...
Mm-hmm. Like, that makes a lot of sense for him to kind of go to TV mm-hmm. at this point in his career. I think a lot of people who've been struggling in film have done more interesting TV lately. Or have kind of found themselves again in TV, so maybe that is... maybe that's revitalized him, and hopefully The Visit will be good. But yeah, I don't, you have any opinions?
Well, I've never been big on M. Night Shyamalan. In fact, borderline dislike on most of his movies.
Mm-hmm.
The more interesting part to me, we already kind of talked about with Blumhouse.
Mm-hmm.
I find them interesting. Maybe not all of their movies are great, but I find their production. He's always trying to push movies can be made cheaper. They, you know, we don't need to make movies on this much money. We don't need to do this, this, and this. This is all just artifice and baloney. And so I find it interesting just to see what his brand or his take on anything can be. So,
yeah. And I feel like the one thing that M. Night Shyamalan needs right now is a good producer.
Well, and I think that they bring sort of a weird energy to their films, and I think that that could be something that he could use as well, so.
Right, if he kind of sees a brand that he needs to fit into, rather than just, you know, going off on his crazy auteur journey and making some crazy weird thing with, like, plants eating people or whatever the hell.
We could talk about brands, him living up to a brand, but...
Right.
I think one of the more sore spots for everybody with Airbender.
The Last Airbender, yeah. And I think that's going to be his biggest hurdle as far as like getting that taste out of everyone's mouth and you know him going back to the well with horror might be the way to go. I mean, I think he needs a good producer and I think he needs a good writer. And so hopefully he can get his mojo back again, because I really do think like his first like three films were pretty good.
Maybe a good life coach too. Well, I mean, while we're adding these things, needs a guru of some sort.
All right, what's your first story?
My first story is about the video game series Borderlands. Lionsgate has just picked it up to adapt it into a big tentpole kind of movie. Actually, when I first heard this news, I was positive because I think that the game could lend to a really cool adaptation, and it certainly has a fun visual style. It's like Mad Max meets Star Wars, kind of in a way.
Right.
There's more like creatures and it's set on another planet, but it's very Mad Maxian and people with, you know, bunch of raiders and things like that. But mm-hmm. One of the things that I guess I'm not too keen on is Ave and Ariard are some of the lead producers on it. And I've never...
Who?
While they're only producers, Ave and Arad
Oh,
Ered.
okay, yeah.
He's done a lot of like he did a lot of the Marvel stuff. He was I think part of the kind of first push Blade, Ghost Rider, X-Men, Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Spider-Man. I mean, he worked for Marvel and then he eventually jumped into feature film. I think he might have done RoboCop or something else like that as well. So, I mean, he has some good stuff and some bad stuff, but I think more of late he's been a little schlocky is the best way to say it. So I'm not... So it could go two ways. I think that this could make a really visually stunning, really cool movie, especially with the style and the bright colors, because in an even better way of saying, like, Mad Max meets... The Fifth Element, like take the colors and the look and everything from that movie, but
right.
then you know,
but kind so, of more over the top elements, right?
Yeah, and I think that it's
not Cormac McCarthy's The Road.
No, it could be a very it could be a really cool adaptation, I think. But
now, video games haven't arrived when it comes to cinema adaptations.
Right.
We've yet to see the one, the breakthrough, the, you know, it's Bryan Singer's X-Men.
Well, I think...
That, like, gets it right and, like, popularizes the form, and then everyone starts buying up video game properties. They've eked them out every once in a while, and they continually seem to fail or underwhelm. Most recently, the Agent 47, which failed on arrival.
Right, which
and most people forgot that that's the second one they've tried.
I thought that was like the third. I thought they had a direct-to-DVD release of one.
Oh, who knows? They might have. I know there was one with Timothy Oliphant like back in like 2010 or something.
Sure, sure.
And then there was this recent one that I just looked so pointless, and I've heard nothing good about.
Well, it depends on the series too. Like I know that they're developing. They've just released the first images of Assassin's Creed with Michael Fassbender.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a step in the right direction. And then I'm still holding out hope for Warcraft World. Duncan
Jones. Yeah.
That's his last name. Duncan Jones is adaptation of that, because he's a hell of a director. And the way that they've set up the story and the different characters seems really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that video games can. I just think you have to have the right person, and I don't know if I think we're barely maybe starting to tap into the right age group to kind of produce them correctly and make them correctly, because I don't think that there were a lot of directors from a former generation that really understood or got video games. So
right, and I think you have to respect that they are two different mediums.
That's
and
true.
I think a lot of people who make video game movies, or a lot of the directors who've tried to tackle it, have tried to cherry pick things they think the audience are going to want to see, like based upon what's in the game, and then they just try and like build a movie around these cherry picked ideas, right, rather than tell a good story, get a screenplay locked down that has a, you know, a good solid three act, you know, structure, and then fit in the aesthetic video game stuff over it. It's exactly like the comic book thing. Like, look how many years it took. You know, we had a few good ones with like the first couple Batman movies and the first couple Superman movies, but there was pretty much nothing but mediocre to awful movies in between until you know, arguably the first Blade movie, and then really with the first X-Men and Spider-Man movie, and that like blew up, that like cracked the code. Somehow everyone was able to go, oh, okay, all we have to do is like take it even like a tiny bit seriously.
Which Ave and Ari, they were both a part of. Mm-hmm. So there might be a similar thinking there, and it might be true, but I don't know. This one specifically, I could go both ways with. I don't think with Borderlands, it has to have somebody that completely gets it and actually would spend the time with a video game. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think that's one of the biggest problems with people adapting, is I don't think that they understand the material.
No, they probably don't, or they just get like interns or development people to kind of, like I said, give them the Cliff's Notes on what the game's about and the things they think need to be in it.
Right.
And then, you know, the script is just kind of cobbled together around it, and that's how it feels. It feels like a bunch of set pieces, a lot of aesthetics, with zero characterizations.
Yeah, and I think that might be a part of the problem too, is because there are quite a few video games that kind of have a blank slate person in order for the person to, you know, the person who's playing, the actual player, to kind of inhabit and kind of decide in that person's skin. Definitely not in the first generations, you know, Super Mario Brothers or anything like that. But for something like Agent 47 or something like that, I think that or Assassin's Creed, Prince of Persia, any of those. Yeah. It's kind of a blank slate, man with no name kind of
thing.
Equation.
Uh-huh.
But I this one has four very, you know, it has some very colorful characters, and it could be, and if they do not just the action, right, but they do the comedy and the kind of like weird sense of humor that the game has, it could be pretty cool on screen, I think. So.
Okay. All right. I've seen it played a little bit, though. All right. My last story that I have here, the Doctor Strange movie that, I can't think of his name right now. Scott Derrickson is going to be directing, the director of Sinister, for the Marvel Studios. They're eyeing Mads Mikkelsen, who played Hannibal in the Hannibal TV show. He was also the villain in Casino Royale, The Hunt, which we just talked about a little bit ago.
It's been a ton of Nicholas Refn movies.
Right, yeah, he was in the Pusher trilogy and that kind of stuff. They're looking at him to play the villain opposite Benedict Cumberbatch in the Doctor Strange movie. And he's a good villain. He's a guy to go to for that. And he has that kind of weird quality,
mm-hmm.
like in a Benedict Cumberbatch / Tilda Swinton, who's also in this movie, way.
They've got a sweet cast if all of this comes around, because somebody we'll be talking about on the show, they've also got Chitwell Ejiofor as well. Mm-hmm. That is a pretty badass cast, if I must say, if that's the full cast.
Yeah.
Talking more about Mads Mikkelsen, yes, they should put him in every movie. Like, I'm very adamant about this, actually. I love him.
Him and Tilda Swinton should just be, they should be in the Muppet Babies movie.
Yes, they would make it better. I mean, it'd be really creepy with Mads Mikkelsen. I could only imagine. They've rumored the character, for the more nerdy, I guess, people out there, that Dormammu, the demon, would be the villain that Mads Mikkelsen would interpret. The other one that I would like to see in a Doctor Strange movie is the villain Nightmare.
You'll have to explain both of these to me.
Dormammu is one of the several Satans of
the MCU.
Of the MCU, because there's also Mephisto, and I think I'm missing one. But Dormammu, I can't remember if I think he's the alternate dimension demon Lucifer guy. Well, he's kind of a weird one, because besides trying to just destroy the earth and, you know, take it over or overrule it with demons, the other thing is he tries to ruin Peter Parker's relationships. Those are his two big things that I know about him.
Take over the world and ruin Spider-Man's relationships.
Yeah, you know, the important things that a demon needs to do.
Right.
Nightmare is basically, he's kind of like a Freddy Krueger character. There's like a specific realm of dream that can be tapped into, and he's just a nefarious dude that runs around bad dreams, and he mostly just looks cool. I think that's why I've always liked him. But I can't say that I have this, like, there's always these like few side characters that you're like, man, they're so badass. But then when it comes to shove, you've read like three things with them in it. I haven't read a lot with him in it. I just think he's a cool villain. And I think that Scott Dickerson and an adaptation of him could look really cool on the screen. Cause I can see the adaptation going a few ways. But with Marvel's kind of, the way that they kind of use, you know, already existing movie genres, it seems like they're trying to tap into the more horror-y elements of the MCU and of the horror genre. And I could see that being very cool. Like, the other movie that Scott Dickerson did,
Derrickson.
What did I say?
You said
did I say
Dickerson.
Dickerson? I thought it was Dickerson, but Derrickson. He did Deliver Us From Evil. That movie is really good until the last like 10, 15 minutes.
Oh, did you see that? I never even saw it.
Yeah, I actually thought it was really cool until the last 15 minutes, and then it ruins almost the whole movie, and you don't want to watch it again. But
did you see it on DVD, or did you see it in theater?
Blu-ray.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I mean, the first part of that film is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
There's kind of some weird casting. It's got Joe McHale in Deliver Us From Evil. That's a little...
distracting.
It's a little distracting. It kind of works by the end, but it's pretty distracting at first.
Right.
But the overall look and how he develops it is really cool. So I think it could really work. And with that cast, I'm more excited than I have been for an original Marvel movie, I think.
I am too. And I've always seen like a specific, like I always wanted to make this movie, like, just because I saw it a very specific way, which mm-hmm. is probably bad, like, because it's no way going to, like, match my very specific mind as far as what I think the movie should be. But so far, everything that I'm seeing about this, who they got to direct, the people they have involved as actors,
Well, looks... they also talked about, like, 1960s psychedelia. 1960s superhero psychedelia horror. That sounds badass to me. I can't.
It's going to be like a combination between like Hellraiser and Roger Corman's The Trip.
We can only hope. I mean, we might be building this up. We might be sorely disappointed with the version we have going already. But Tilda Swinton's in it, so it can't be bad.
Yeah, she'll at least be good there.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, that pretty much does us for the movie news. And let's go ahead and get into our first review.
Okay.
Which is, this was a very low attended weekend. Even if we had done a wide release movie, the listeners had probably not watched it. So why not go ahead and watch something cool and limited and, you know, hopefully
something we'd want to talk about.
Something that we wanted to talk about. Yeah. Although there's a small percentage of me that kind of wanted to see We Are Your Friends, and probably still will. So
is that one?
That's the Zac Efron EDM movie that, like, apparently is, like, next to Oogie Loves is one of the worst grossing wide release movies.
Yeah, I'm not... Yeah, no. You could have done that one by yourself. I did see that now that you're talking about it. He's, like, a DJ or some crap.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
Okay, go on.
I might see that during the week so I can review for the paper and maybe do it for the next episode. But this movie that we're going to be talking about is Z for Zachariah, and it stars Chiwetel Ejiofor, which we talked about a little bit in the last story that we did, Chris Pine, and Margot Robbie, who is kind of breaking out. Was she Oscar nominated for Wolf of Wall Street?
I can't remember. I don't think so, though. Maybe, though.
She might have been. Well, at the very least, she was definitely noticed mm-hmm. in that movie, and she was kind of an unknown and sort of discovered for that film. And...
did she do, like, I thought she did, like, Friday Night Lights or something like that. She was in some TV show
mm-hmm.
before that. Vaguely popular.
Yeah. And now she's in this movie and she's going to be in the Suicide Squad. And I've seen her, you know, a lot of different casting, things that I've been, reading about lately. So
she was in that other Will Smith movie.
Yeah. Focus.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's it.
And this is directed by Craig Zobel, who I didn't know until I looked it up after, but he did the movie, Compliance, which we reviewed in our Netflix homework mm-hmm. a while back.
Correct.
Which makes a lot of sense, because if you look at Compliance and you look at this movie, they're both very similar in the sense that they're really small cast, very contained locations, and kind of chamber pieces.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
I
had the exact same like realization. I was like, oh, it's that guy. That makes sense.
Right. And the story here is it's the post-apocalypse. But it's
a little different than Compliance, just a little there.
A little bit different than Compliance as far as our setting goes. It's a post-apocalypse, and we're in the middle of this very lush, beautiful valley that for some reason, possibly spiritual, possibly scientific, we don't know, The valley has been spared the apocalypse that's destroyed the rest of the world and most of society. There's a few people who were luckily underground when whatever happened.
Or in Magic Valley.
Or in this Magic Valley. Margot Robbie is kind of holding down the fort of her farmhouse and some of the small locations that kind of are satellited around her house. Is a gas station that she goes to get food every once in a while. There's a clean fishing pond that she can use every once in a while. She's can still grow her own crops in fertile soil. And for whatever reason, there's this tiny little utopia in the middle of the post-apocalypse. She goes out on extended trips every once in a while with her dog, kind of a end-of-the-world trope. And she runs into another survivor. She'd been basically alone since her family left her there when they went to go look for survivors. She'd been alone for probably something like a year. She eventually runs into Chiwetel Ejiofor, who's a little shaken, a little stirred. He's been kind of struggling on his own. He was a civil engineer, so he had a anti-radiation suit that he could kind of walk around and survive in. But he's been really struggling, and she kind of helps him and sort of nurses him back to health. And they're going to basically rebuild society as they know it between the two of them from the ground up in this tiny little valley. And everything's kind of going okay and everything's fine until Chris Pine enters the picture, another survivor who was stuck in a mine when the shit hit the van. Mm-hmm. And he kind of enters in and shakes up the dynamic of what was kind of going on between Margot Robbie and Chiwetel Ejiofor's character.
Well, I want to dive into a little bit because this is when the actual movie kind of
starts in a way.
Well, it does start, and it's kind of what it's a little bit more about. I think it takes a long time to kind of build to this. And this is the thing, is the movie's themes are very interesting, but they're few and far between in the world building. This film, I kind of had the exact reaction I thought I was going into it. I thought there was going to be one of two things. It was going to be kind of dumb and I wasn't going to like it, or it was going to be kind of good and I was just going to I was going to watch the first time, enjoy it, and then probably never watch it again. And that was my exact experience.
Okay.
The performances are great. I think all three actors do a really good job. The whole time I was a little, the first movie that I really like noticed Chris Pine in was, Smoking Aces, where he played this really horrible, redneck brother, skinhead. Mm-hmm. And, I kept expecting him to turn into that character. I know he wasn't going to, but I was expecting it. So he distracted me a little bit, but
okay. I have an opinion about that, but I'll let you keep going.
But you already mentioned the other important part of this movie, the suit. The suit is very important because it is, like, super badass, and I need it to go to the grocery store.
That's your takeaway.
To do daily chores. Yes,
you want a giant radioactive moon suit to go to the grocery store.
That's my biggest takeaway from this film. to be more serious, though, I think Margot and Robbie and Chiwetel Ejiofor, I think both of them are much more interesting. And I wasn't expecting as much from Margot Robbie for some reason. I don't know why. She's always been decent. But I thought that the way she portrayed the character and everything was very nuanced and very, very, very well portrayed. And I don't think it ever kind of seemed weird. Chris Pine's, I do think it was, and it seemed a little too late. I think his character needed to come in sooner, and they needed to. I don't know. I'm kind of, I guess, split half and half, because I also find the triangular love angle really trite and kind of boring. So there are a bunch of things to stack against this movie for me, and there's a bunch of things that I really liked about the movie. I think it's also shot pretty interestingly and well. It is sort of like Compliance 2, where it's sort of realism. I feel like he took a little bit more time to kind of make it a little bit more ponderous and a little different in this one. But some of the themes that arise in it are very interesting. Like the in these situations, like what is the best and worst that's going to come out of humanity? Do our beliefs, how do they drive us to do the best and the worst things? Also sort of, you know, the rules of attraction and how the world works. Specifically, this little love tryst, was the way that played out was interesting to me and thematically, but again, there's a handful of things. I did find it a little too ponderous and a little maybe boring at times. So it goes back and forth. What did you think about the actual, like, style, I guess, of the film and the actual, like, because you kind of talked about the plot, but.
Right. You know. I like the way it looks a lot. I think that he uses the environment a lot. You know, I called it a chamber piece, but it is very open. It's a lot more. It's not stuck in the back of a chicken restaurant.
No.
It's now, you know, where he uses the entire environment. I want to say he is almost taking inspiration from like a Terrence Malick kind of thing, where the environment kind of plays a character in the movie. And I think that it plays in thematically as well, because there's something going on here, and call me nutty.
Mm-hmm.
Call me crazy.
I don't think you're crazy.
Call me
nutty, but not crazy.
Nutty, but not crazy. Okay, call me crazy, but there's a lot of themes about religion going on here. Margot Robbie is very faithful. They have her father was a minister. And she's kind of, you know, her faith is what drives her and what keeps her surviving. Whereas Chiwetel Ejiofor is a scientist and an atheist. And, you know, wants to do everything as practically as possible. And while at the same time trying to, you know, respect her beliefs. Since they're the only two people alive, as far as they know. There's a metaphor that I'm seeing here that I think is a little bit of like a Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve thing going on here.
Oh yeah, for sure. The whole book in the, A is for Adam. Introduced in the library and
right, and then this is they're kind of like in this mysterious land that, you know, is lush and you know,
somehow protected from the rest of them. Yeah.
And then I see the Chris Pine character is a little bit like the snake, and I think where if you play that metaphor out to its logical extremes, I think there's another metaphor kind of on top of it about feminism and about sort of, you know, because we're supposed to like
that one you're going to have to dig deeper on. I didn't maybe the religious stuff I definitely saw, and the thematics of basically, to me, it was kind of like she's very faith driven and she's challenged by this other person that has very different beliefs, and she kind of bumps heads with him.
Right.
But the other person who, you know, shares her faith and everything like that, eventually kind of does some, he tears down the church. He, I don't know if that's a spoiler.
He clearly seems that he's out more for his own benefit.
Right. And not necessarily as, he doesn't have as good intentions as this other person, and it isn't as good for Margot Robbie's character as Ejiofor's character is.
I think that's sort of what the movie's challenging us. I think that actually the reason that they hold Chris Pine for so long is because they want us to get really, really invested in that original relationship between her and Chiwetel Ejiofor, and we're kind of seeing everything through his eyes. Well, it kind of goes back and forth, the center of consciousness between the two, but I think by the point that Chris Pine gets involved, then we're really seeing things through his eyes. And there's this sort of, and this is where the feminist thing kind of comes up. There's this sort of entitlement of like, she's mine. I was here first.
Sure.
And I think that the movie is kind of playing with that idea of like, you know, like we're supposed to think he's the better man, but in a lot of ways, he's kind of a dick. Like at one point he goes up to Margot Robbie and he says, look, I know what's going on. And I just want to let you know, you can do whatever you want. Like, she needs his permission.
Right.
You know what I mean? And because he's, you know, there's like a weird kind of father thing going on there, too. But also they have this romantic thing that's kind of like hinted at. So between the two, you know, you start to see this, like, aggressive male competition for this only female survivor that they know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that plays out in a really socially interesting way. Also, there's some really interesting stuff that's only hinted at, but I think it's just there because of the casting, maybe. But there's interesting race stuff going on between the three of them, and that kind of idea of, like, familiarity.
Yeah, I think that it does, but I think it's more casting. I think you're right in saying that. See, and I get where I think that you're. I don't think that you're wrong in the feminist take. What I think is, I think it more adds to the bigger thematics, because I think the bigger thematics is interested in, is in the more religious / science, kind of those two frames of. Frames of how you kind of go about life, kind of butting heads in a situation like this.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a macro theme in that's playing out pretty obviously. And then I think as you peel away the layers like an onion, it starts to find these other nooks and crannies, and it complicates that original theme. And I think even in some ways challenges the story of the Garden of Eden as saying, like, you know, here's this Eve who was completely incapable of having agency and is, you know, being told by all the different men in her life, whether it be God, Adam, or the snake, what to do. And then at the end, she's sort of villainized for everything.
See, that's another thing that I guess is interesting that I didn't think of is the unknown God.
Right.
Or father. I guess you could even say her father who left could kind of personify that. The brother who...
It sort of doesn't matter. Like, the movie, like, brings up those things, I don't think you have to, like, come to a decision of whether or not it, for the sake of this movie, God exists.
No.
Because I think metaphorically, he definitely does.
I don't think that it matters. Well, for this film, it doesn't matter. I think that the film is primarily about how it guides us and how that can kind of, no matter what, you know, no matter if you're science-based, like, he's still, like, when it comes to it, he needs that human interaction. He needs that spiritual side of her to kind of exist. Mm-hmm. And he falls in love and becomes enchanted with that because, you know, he doesn't have it or whatever. But then vice versa, I guess my interpretation was that she needed that realism that actually came from a Chris Pine character to take apart the church. But there's always this misgiving. All of them did wrong in some way, but all of them did right in some way. There's one other, I'm just going to say spoiler alert, you can even cut it out of the episode if you don't think it adds, which it might not, but I think it adds to the our conversation at least, is the fact that at the end, I would say that it's sort of ambiguous to whether Chris Pine's character actually left or not.
I would say so too.
And that question kind of left is interesting. Mm-hmm. Now I have my own answers for that, but I don't think it's important because that just gets into what did I think about the film.
Right.
But the film actually has that ambiguous part into it, built into it. So you can read into it the way that you,
yeah,
to interpret the way that you'd like.
I definitely thought about that a lot walking out of the movie and thinking about it, because there was a part of me that, like, as interesting as all of this stuff was, there was a part of me that felt like it was maybe a little too subtle sometimes, and maybe could have used a little bit more of a third act to culminate all of these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But then the more I thought about that ending and sort of the more it sort of lingered in my mind, and I was arguing, you know, did it happen? Did it not happen? Like, what's going on? The more I kind of thought that kind of did its job. I think it pulled all three of those characters together and kind of made the statement I was hoping it would make. And I think that, I think this is a good movie. I don't think that it's, you know, kind of like what I said about, the end of the tour last week, it's not begging you to love it. It's not a particularly flashy or showy movie as far as this genre goes, especially. You know, if you put this up against Mad Max Fury Road, you couldn't have two movies that are completely different other than the subject matter.
Sure.
Even though, weirdly enough, they kind of play in some of the same themes. I think that I came away with this liking it more than not liking it. In a way, like, you know, Craig Zobel, looking at Compliance, then looking at this movie, I think he's building an interesting body of work. And I think that it almost kind of reminded me in some ways, you know, I mentioned Malick, maybe some of his earlier films, but also, now I can't think of her name. We did Wendy and Lucy and Meek's Cutoff.
I'm aware of Meek's Cutoff, but I don't know. I don't know the Lucy one. I haven't seen either of them, so
it's
it's
going to kill me.
Should look it up. But yeah. This film in general, I agree with you, and I did like the film, but I had to automatically pose caution because I don't think that there's very much lasting. You brought up The End of Poor. That movie for me kind of left a little bit more of an impact. Mm-hmm. For me, and I think besides the great performances, I think that the themes were, I felt like, done a little better. But in this one, it felt very, even though it was like the end of the world, maybe the last three people in the left on the planet, it felt very inconsequential to me. I was like, I don't give a shit. Let the dogs and the bunnies and all that just, you know, run around and live.
But if you see it as a parable, doesn't that, I mean, you don't have to love the characters.
It's not about the characters. It's about the film itself. It just doesn't have a last. I don't feel like, even just outside of like how it affected me, I don't think that it's a powerful enough. Maybe it was a little too subtle. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it took a little too long. Maybe it was a little too breathy. I don't know. But I don't feel like it has a huge impact. And I don't think that it's going to be, I think a certain people will be like, oh yeah, it was kind of cool. But I can't see anybody being over the moon about this.
No, but again, I don't think that it's trying to. I think it is aiming for exactly what it's doing. I think it's a pure film. It's pure in its intentions, and I think that it accomplishes what it's going for. I don't think it's trying to make a really grand statement or to have a very big explosive impact.
I'm not talking about necessarily it what it's trying to do. I'm talking about it's literally lasting power on me afterwards and right. How I felt about it, because I would say The End of Torres is the similar. I think it was trying either, but yeah. That movie had more of a connection for me, where this movie I was just kind of like, yeah, it was good. And then it was kind of a one and done for me.
Right. I mean, there's something about it that's sort of unabashedly melodramatic.
That is very true. Yes.
In a very traditional kind of way.
It could be a stage play.
It very easily could be. Yes. I just came away with it kind of appreciating it. Maybe not loving it. I don't know if I would need to buy it. I don't know if I would need to, like, you know, get everyone together and say, we got to go see this movie. It's not really one of those kind of movies. And I think that it's okay that it's not one of those kind of movies. I think it's okay that it's just something you see and mull over around in your head a little bit. But I think that I appreciated what it was going for and what I think it accomplished. And for nothing else, just to see three really good performers perform very well.
I completely agree. Completely agree. But I mean, the overall, because I mean, I guess that's the point. Mm-hmm. of reviewing is to kind of like put your little two cents in or whatever about it, which my two cents was, if you know, this isn't Mad Max, definitely don't see it for those reasons. But if you're looking for something to kind of, if you're interested in the things we've already talked about, the themes, these type of movies, these actors, then yeah, check it out. I just don't, I just couldn't see anybody being like, oh my gosh, Z for Zachariah blew my mind or anything like that.
Right.
I think it's something that you would eat. To me, this is like an appetizer. It's something you kind of let sit on your tongue and kind of just get the flavor a little bit of. It's right. Not something that you indulge in. It's not a full meal.
The director I was talking about earlier was Kelly Reichardt, by the way.
No, okay.
And yeah, if you're a fan of her movies, but for sure see this, because, I mean, this is like Mad Max Fury Road compared to Meek's Cutoff. And I like her movies.
But I don't know if you've sold me, but I have. I am curious about that one. But
okay, well, let's go ahead and get into our Netflix homework. So now for something completely different. And I'll let you set this up.
Oh, man. Let's just get the name out. Just say it. The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. The Butcher, the Baker, the Candlestick Maker, the Launderer, the... Like, I could go on.
The Liar.
Yes, the Liar, the Lover, the Magician, the Hound Dog, the his pal, Benny.
And the wardrobe.
Yes. And they go through a magical wardrobe. The director, Peter Greenaway, he wrote and directed this. He's of somewhat note. You might be able to speak more on that a little bit. Mm-hmm. But he's well known in the British world. But this is basically about this kitchen in England that's owned by this horrible man, played by Michael Gambon.
Yeah, most people probably know as not Gandalf, but the other one.
Oh, Dumbledore.
Dumbledore. Yeah. Yeah. Very different part here.
Yes, and his wife Helen Mirren is kind of this like artsy rich lady, and they own this kind of fancy. He's bought this really fancy kitchen with one of the best cooks, and they go here every week or every night, I guess. And they get the meal, the du jour. And basically what happens is she meets this other guy who she falls in love with. She falls in sex with, and right. They do it a lot in the bathroom and in the kitchen. It's a little prettier than I described it, but it will do for what I was saying. It kind of goes on, and it becomes, you know, he's this like Michael Gambon is like this gangster type and pretty dangerous. And throughout you kind of see him starting to discover and her lover in the bathroom and in the kitchen and how it plays out and how it affects the kitchen staff and how it affects everybody with this crazy gangster named Albert. The film sounds more, when I describe it that way, seems a lot more
standard
and contrite than it really is, because there's a lot of crazy stylistic shit going on here. Besides the colors, there's tons of just like gratuitous sex, and not in a bad way. Like it matches. It makes sense within the movie. There's some very rapey stuff. There's some very violent stuff. Now this was my first take. My first take on the film was this was a film about Phil.
Okay.
Michael Gambon's character, kind of stood for the money. And the cook was like the director, and it had all this different part that made the movie. And the Helen Mirren's character represented the actor, and the lover represented the writer.
Interesting.
Now all of this kind of played out to show that, you know, who ruins, you know, something that could be so great in film is these money men. Now that's what I thought it was, and especially because there's this scene where it's the only scene that the lover and the actress stop having sex, and the one thing that they talk about is film.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, aha, that has to be it. But then I read other reviews, and people were talking about Margaret Thatcher and how Michael Gambon's character stood in for that, and like the kitchen staff and everything was like the working class, and so on. And you know, the lover was the intellectuals, and Helen Mirren actually stood for Britain or whatever. I disagree with them. I stand with my own take.
Okay.
But I don't know if that's so far removed. And I don't know. The other thing, I don't have a familiarity enough with the director to really say it was this or that. But this movie altogether was kooky and fun, and I liked it.
Fun.
It had a lot of weird charm to it. Yes, I thought it was fun. It was black humor. Black.
Oh, as pitch black as it gets.
That is true. Again, if I did say rapey and I did say ultraviolet. So yeah, there you go.
Well, I think there's a lot of interesting things going on in this movie, and it kind of took me a little while to get into the rhythm of it.
Yes,
because it is so stylized. I mean,
it's not a normal flow of many films I've seen either.
It's kind of weird because there's a lot of weird parallels with Z for Zachariae, even though both movies are so very different.
Yes.
This is both. It's another love triangle. This is another kind of chamber piece in a way, because even though there's a large cast, it's shot on this soundstage that's very obviously a soundstage.
Another reason why I thought it was a film about film.
Yes, it really draws attention to its artifice. You become intimately aware of the set because there's these long takes that pan across it as they're walking from room to room to room.
And there's a chorus. Like, I don't know, like, if they're doing like a Greek kind of chorus or she was just like a musical chorus. I couldn't tell. It could be either.
The choir boy. Yeah. And his songs kind of like become the score in a way. So it feels very much like a stage play. Mm-hmm. You could do this as a stage play. And so, yeah, I think your read of the movie, I didn't think about it in that way, but I think that is extremely valid. And you should write that paper.
Done. If it hasn't been already,
And then, you know, file that for when the Criterion decide to release it, and you could be your essay in the booklet.
It should be.
But I think the what you mentioned before, I didn't think about that either, but, you know, as a Thatcher metaphor, that works just fine. And I think that the overall effect of the movie is that this is one of the most abrasive films I've watched in a while.
Really?
Yeah, I think, you know, the style is very kind of garish, I dare say. It's beautiful, but mm-hmm. it's also, you know, on a very aggressive style. You know, the rooms are, you know, one room is completely red, then the next is completely green, and then the bathrooms are completely white. And so, you know, it's
well, they have, like, Helen Mirren's character, her wardrobe changes according to the room's color, as well as her cigarettes. And so there are some very interesting stylistics just going on with that. But
right, yeah. And, you know, Michael Gambon is playing the worst person in the world.
As arch as hell, yes.
Yeah, like, you can't get more evil than this guy. And more unlikable than this guy. And I could see some people thinking just for his performance alone that the movie's a little grating. Also, this is, you know, very, I suppose edgy is the word you would use. There's a lot of sex in here. I mentioned last week, when I assigned this, that this was one of the first NC-17 movies to kind of get a lot of recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And I also thought about this in terms of this was like kind of the beginning of a new indie explosion. Cause this came out in 1989. So this was also the same year the Sex Lies and Videotape came out. Hmm. And, around the same time, I want to say within a year or two of Cinema Paradiso. And all three of those movies were kind of championed as like the beginning of something new as far as like foreign and indie stuff. And I think it's kind of interesting to look at it in this context. I didn't, you know, if anybody, it's kind of weird looking at these actors now, especially Helen Mirren, who's pretty much an old lady now.
But she was also in Caligula. I mean,
yeah, that's true. I mean, she has a history of, even now, like, she's kind of like the cougar, like, or the grandma cougar.
Grar, yeah.
But, you know, back then she's going for it.
Yeah, and I bought it. I mean, I think the other reason I could tap into this pretty easily, this film is, and I looking through his body of work, he has a film called 8.5 Women. Like, this is very Fellini,
yes,
kind of esque kind of film. And very so for much. Me, it was, because I'd seen so many of these, it was easy for me to get the rhythms of the film right away, because I'm like, oh, this kind of reminds me of, the one they're on a ship. That's not Armacord. I can't remember which one that is, but they're on a ship. It's one of his better films. I really like that one. But
yeah, no, for the little bit of Fellini I've seen, I eventually caught on to that. I was like, oh, okay. There's a, well, besides just Fellini, there's a, just in general, just a very Italian style to this movie.
Right.
And the way, especially the way you use it, they use sexuality and sort of black humor, and it all kind of plays. I even thought a little bit about Pasolini and Salo in some of its gratuity, and also the sort of like using gratuity as a subversiveness to talk about other things.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of his use of the camera and like letting it just pan across a room and like fill the frame with this kind of gorgeous architecture while these grotesque things are happening in the middle of it. And you know, that those kind of juxtapositions, yeah, reminded me a lot of Pasolini. I like the movie a lot. Eventually kind of came around to it. The ending is one of those endings. The ending is like, that's kind of for me when I decided, oh no, this is brilliant.
Yeah, like, no, it wraps it up perfect. And then that's when I think it, I was into it before that, but that was the coffin though for me. I was like, yep, this is it. I like it.
So I definitely recommend it, but I'm going to say there's a good chance that most people are not going to like this.
No, this is for a very specific type. You have to like art films. I think you have to be able to kind of be a little experimental. And you also have to be able to, you have to like a film that kind of just...
is a little bit of a freak out.
Well, a little bit of a freak out and a little bit of a... you have to be able to go there. You know, you have to be able to traverse like David Cronenberg and those kind of like themes, maybe not body horror so much, but per se, but the way
there's grotesque quality stuff in here, but it's shot so like, it's lit so pretty. It's like, it's almost in like, in a way, like almost like Argento-ish.
Well,
it
is sort of Argento-ish, or I was thinking, I keep going back to a musical. Like that's just kept, that just, again, my first take on this was film. This is a film about film.
It's very cine literary, and in a way, I considered, you know, obviously it's a much newer film than maybe took some inspiration from this, but I also considered Holy Motors.
Oh, sure, that actually makes Holy Motors make a lot more sense.
Mm-hmm.
So the Fellini films that I was thinking was Ship Sail On. I also would say Ginger and Fred, and well, obviously like La Dolce Vita and things like that, but I think this film is a lot of fun. I would say it would appeal more to somebody who likes those edgier films than something like a Fellini film would.
Or if you're like, I would say there might be like a certain kind of theater geek who really loves like just big productions and like production value and like, you know, use of like color and filters and costuming and that
and
kind of stuff.
There's a lot of that to
like the artifice of it is just sort of immense.
Oh yeah. I sort of tapped into that. Was like, oh, this is cool. Oh, I like that. That's a cool, like little,
and even kind of vaguely campy in a very purposeful way.
Well, it's also a very intellectual movie though too.
Yeah.
There were lots
of stuff going on here.
Well, there were a lot of, references made that were over my head, but I knew that they were referencing something.
The other thing I thought about a lot when I was watching this, especially the end,
mm-hmm.
is I thought, I really wish this director had done the Sweeney Todd movie.
yeah, that makes complete sense. Actually, some of the better performances, I guess, that's what I've heard of, is they do Sweeney Todd like super like happy,
mm-hmm.
and so it just makes the whole thing seem off. Whereas it was more about the grotesque kind of Victorian, almost horror-esque, was
Tim Burton's
take. And I don't think that it brought out some of the better black comedy of that film. So,
agreed. And you asked me about the director. The only other movie I've seen by him was a movie he did called The Pillow Book with Ewan McGregor. And all I really remember about that is that you saw his wang. It was like one of the many movies that Ewan McGregor did where you saw his penis.
Huh. Is this a thing? Do we need to talk about this?
No, or? I saw this when I was like on IFC. It was one of those IFC moments.
I see.
I had a lot of those as a kid. And I it was way over my head, and I had no idea what it was about. And I probably wasn't watching it with a lot of volume on anyway. But anyway, so I like this movie.
Yeah, I did too. I
And I would be willing
I cautiously
to, like,
recommend
revisit.
it to the I well, I cautiously recommend it to most people. I fully recommend it to the ones that we said it might appeal to.
Yes.
Because I actually did really like this film, so.
Mm-hmm. And this is the one I would think, just because, especially because of, like, the camera work and the colors and everything, I'd love to see this projected at some point in my life.
Agreed.
Okay, cool. Well, what do you have for us next week, Richard?
Next week, I think I got this title right. The Monkey Hustle. I'm a little, I don't know, saying it, I got a little tame just because I believe it's a black exploitation film from the 70s. Mm-hmm. We don't know. I just saw this man's garish, I don't know, a blouse. He has this gold choker thing that matches. It's, I just saw it and I said, yeah, we need to watch this film. I don't
this,
know. Yeah,
this is a Netflix deep dive.
We have no idea what's in store. This could be boring like Blackula. So
I'm excited.
I am too.
I'm excited for the Monkey Hustle.
Yes.
And that's the movie's name. Don't get mad.
Yeah, we're not being racist. I feel like it when I say it, but we're not.
And if anybody has anything to say about any of the movies we talked about this week, whether it's Z for Zachariah, The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover, or The Monkey Hustle, if you happen to catch that before we do the next episode, please email us with your comments at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/jabberpodcast, where we post all of our news items and new episodes when they go up. Follow us on Twitter at Jabber Podcast, all one word. You can also find us on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. And if you listen to us there, or subscribe to us there, you can leave us a star rating and a one sentence review. We are also searchable under the Zune and Windows Podcast Network, as well as Pocket Cast. You can read my reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can read Richard's stuff that he did at his blog, rdwally.weebly.com. You can read some of the reviews and articles I've written for the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Be sure to listen to Brad, Amanda, and Alyssa over at their podcast, Quarter Life Crisis, at quartercrisis.podbean.com. Listen to our friend Leland over at his podcast in Olympia, Washington, Dampercast. Posts something like 2 or 3 episodes a week. Super prolific, that guy.
He does stuff. And he's funny.
Right. And he has a much better setup than we do, and, you know, generally has a much better show than we do. And be sure to listen to us on the next episode of Make Dad Read Comics with Patrick and his father from Detroit. We're going to be reading our homework that we have to do. We have two homeworks this week, the movie that we're doing for next week, and for his show, we're going to be reading the first volume of Parker and discussing it with them.
Yeah, I'm super excited because maybe people don't know. My interest actually, I'm probably more into comics than I am movies and as a medium, and I really love movies, but I'm super excited to do this because it's different.
You get to geek out.
I do get to geek out, but it beyond that, like I get it. Mm-hmm. I've done this so much that talking about film is just like, oh yeah, films exist, and I haven't got to do this, so I'm super excited.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we do talk enough about comics on this podcast, but I could do with it more in my life.
All right.
So I'm super, super stoked for this.
And yeah, we're recording that over the weekend, and then I think the episode's probably going to go up Monday or Tuesday, so I'll definitely share that on our Facebook and Twitter, which is another reason why people should be following us there. And we'll give you more updates as we go along.
Yeah, we do stuff too. Not as much as Leland, but we do stuff.
We'll talk to you next week.
Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.